Thanks for joining us this morning. And I want to also thank everybody who came out to Mod Pizza last week and supported us. It was a fun event, and I appreciate everybody being there. My guests today are Wyatt McCray.
Good morning.
From Edward Jones. And Mark Barnes, who's been on several times. He's the owner of Copper Canyon Tax Service. And we're going to be talking about some of the changes that are made, not just in financing, taxes, but in the mortgage industry. And I don't usually do shows about loans because they're boring, but here we go.
We're going to make it exciting.
Okay. Definitely. I'm waiting. We do have some changes. VAs, if your VA loan didn't close by the 31st, and that means funded by the 31st, not your loan application taken, there's going to be an increase in fees, funding fees, and you can see those increases at the VA website, and there's a whole page dedicated to what's coming down the pike. And also on the reverse mortgages, they've raised the limit to over $700,000. The exact figure is $765,600. So that's good news. So what do you guys have changing, new and approved for 2020?
Well, Congress finally did something.
Oh, yay. When that happened?
Last couple weeks.
Oh.
They've pushed through some legislation. We have some extenders that have been resuscitated. So things like excluding cancellation of debt on your primary residence, that's back again. They've put the ability to deduct your medical expenses back to 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. We have tuition and fees deduction that's been resurrected again. These are all items that hit the books, and they're usually single year items. So we go through this a lot. A lot of these things have died off and then they come back, usually for 1 year, sometimes 2 years. So literally in 12 months, we can have the same exact conversation about some of these things. And they've also made some major changes to your retirement accounts, your ability to deduct for a birth or adoption. You have rule changes to your required minimum distributions. So that's going to change some things on the tax side. And then if you inherit an IRA, they have changed that significantly. Those are usually done over your lifetime, and they're going to minimize that now, and you have to take that money over a 10-year period.
Okay. I ran a scenario by you beginning of the year where I did a closing for a couple who, through this scam with the wire transfers, they lost $50,000. And you said at that time that there was no way they could take it off on their taxes as a loss or anything. Has that changed?
There's been some changes in there, but not that specific side of it. What we had was the disaster loss provisions had changed. And up until 2 weeks ago, you had to be in a presidentially declared disaster area in order to have a deductible tax item. They've removed that provision of it. So okay. Now if you're in a disaster area, it doesn't have to be presidentially declared in order for you to have a qualifying deduction. It just came out. I don't know if deep down in the fine print, they've changed the total definition of it where your loss for this escrow account would be deductible. I can't answer that quite yet.
Okay. And what changes do you have, Wyatt?
Well, Mark kind of covered them.
Thank you, Mark.
With the required minimum distributions and the stretch IRAs. So
let's go into detail about this. What about the IRAs?
So with anyone that has deferred income in a traditional IRA or on a 401k, they were required by the government when they turned 70 and a half to take out a certain percentage starting at 70 and a half the year that you turn.
70 in 6 months.
In 6 months, correct.
Okay.
And it looks like that the federal government's changing that now to 72. And so anyone that is turning 70 and a half come next year in 2020, it's actually going to be pushed to age 72. So looking to see more details on that and exactly how that's going to affect. I'm just waiting on more details on that for future.
All right. So I want to talk about maximizing your Social Security benefits. What good advice do you have for our listeners?
One, Social Security is complicated when you get to the calculating it outside of it. And a lot of what we see is people shortchanging themselves in their 30s and early 40s because of whatever reason. It's not going to be there for me. I'm invincible. You know, I've heard it all. Those are some of your best years when you get to the actual calculation process of it. When you get to the retirement side of it, it becomes very specific. And this is why we have a consultation. We don't sell anything. I'm not talking you into an annuity. I'm here to give advice, and we want to look at a variety of things. But the important things are you prepared for retirement? What's your family history look like? And then we look at your other assets and see how all this is going to work for you with the goal to make sure you don't run out of money. And a lot of people, they rush down at 62 and they start collecting because they can, and they've put no thought into this process at all. And then at 85, they regret that decision. And so, like, there's a lot of things that go into this, and you have to really come back to a reality check of where you are in life and what your family history looks like before you start making that decision.
I think the key point is that everyone's situation is different, and you got to take them for where they are and what's affecting them specifically. And like Mark says, a lot of people shortchange themselves, and they think that life isn't going to treat them well, and that they're going to be going a little bit sooner. But time and time again, I meet people that regret taking Social Security too early. And for some people, it is the right thing to do. But in most cases, we can look at things and kind of plan out what's going to be most effective for them and in their best interest.
So once your people really sit down and have that conversation with themselves or an advisor and start planning for their retirement, when should they start?
Early.
18.
Yeah. I mean, when you consider the time value of money, the best time to start this is early. And the earlier you start it, the less you have to save monthly and the more money you'll have at retirement. If you start saving at age 20, you can save a very small amount of money. It will grow over your lifetime, and you can retire a millionaire. And if you wait till age 50 and you will have the same expectations, you have to save $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 a month just because you've delayed this process out. So retirement's really something you need to think about first, and then start your career path and buying houses and buying cars and all these other things. Unless you're going to make a lot of money and be able to save a lot of money, most people need to think about this earlier rather than later.
The sooner you start, the better. You know, at your 20s, it's better than your 30s. Your 30s are better than your 40s, and so on.
So when somebody comes in and they bring their teenager to talk to you, Wyatt, yeah, what lecture do you give them?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the time value of money, too, what Mark said there. It's really just educating. What can $1,000 in 1 year do for you invested-wise? And what they can do when looking at their own lives and the amount of money that they are accruing for that year. If they're working at 16 years old or 18 years old, how are they budgeting their money? How are they using that wisely for right now and for the future?
Or are they just going out and blowing it?
Yeah, which is mostly what happens.
What happens. You know, it's unfortunate, but actually, that is what happens. We're going to talk about reverse mortgage when we come back. But I also want to know what you guys did for Christmas and what your plans are for the new year besides reading new tax laws and mortgage laws and funding laws. So we're going to take a break. We'll be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. Our guest today is Mark Barnes and Wyatt McCray. And if you have any questions for our advisors here, the number is 790-2040. And they're the ones to ask. They know it all. Well, all of that stuff. The reverse mortgage, sometimes people, it's got a bad reputation. Sometimes people just want to stay away from it because it does have a bad reputation. And they earned it. But it is actually a good loan. The government got involved and put restrictions on it. And if you notice, the big banks don't do them anymore. So you've got mortgage companies who have a lot of accountability when it comes to putting a reverse mortgage together. But this is something that, you know, tax-wise, this is a huge benefit to people. Mark, you want to talk about the reverse mortgage and how people can use this?
Sure. When you get into the retirement side of it, it opens up a ton of opportunities that you may or may not have had. From a tax perspective, it really is fantastic for you because you're just accessing the equity that you have, and it's a non-taxable transaction. Nothing's been sold, so you didn't create any type of a capital gain. And effectively, you're taking money out of your left pocket and you're sticking it in your right pocket, and that's not taxable to you. So you could access hundreds of thousands of dollars, have additional money for vacations, new car, home repairs, partying. None of my business. And it doesn't create any tax for you. On the opposite side of it, the tax law changes from 2017 limited your interest deduction to interest that was from purchasing, building, or improving your primary residence. And since this qualifies as none of those three items, interest that would be paid is non-deductible, which is a small change, but with the new standard deduction being higher, it may or may not have had any effect on your tax return anyway.
So if I'm going to, and like I said at the beginning of the show, they've raised the amount considerably to $765,600. So if you're sitting on a house that's paid off or mostly paid off, this is something you should tap into. And I've, you know, just to give out some stories, I have a grandma who just really needed a little bit extra in her monthly income. And so she did a reverse mortgage. And every month she takes a chunk of that income and gives it to her financial advisor and has an account for her granddaughter. So, you know, she's got the best of both worlds. Tell people how they can use this to their advantage, Wyatt.
Yeah, in that situation with the grandmother, she was taken care of financially with the reverse mortgage, and then she had a little bit left over. And in the case of giving money to her granddaughter, she could have done that in many different ways. One could have been in a 529 account, which is a college education or educational account used for educational purposes. That money is invested and grows for that grandchild tax-free if used for educational purposes. Or she could have put it into a custodial account, which is a regular brokerage account that is a gift to the granddaughter for her legacy. And at a certain age, depending on the state that she lives in, that granddaughter would receive those funds with any kind of interest or gains that would have accrued during that time of contributing.
So if somebody wants to put money into a college fund, mm-hmm. are those funds restricted to college?
College or any kind of educational. If a child is going to a private school for high school, you could use it for that. Anything for educational purposes, room and board, books, tuition, those kind of.
So what if they get an internship and they're working for a company and they skip college, but you know they're being mentored through some type of a career path?
In some instances, if you have like a trade school, there are certain qualifications for that. If by chance the individual doesn't use the money, and that can be, that beneficiary can be changed to someone else, could your next door neighbor, your other grandchild,
somebody you pick off the street.
Yeah, or it could be just kept in that account, and if the grandchild decides to go back to school at another time, 5 years later, 10 years later, they could use it for that as well.
It keeps growing.
It does.
So what, you named a couple of different accounts. Are there any restrictions on the other accounts?
There's always restrictions to certain accounts if you're getting benefits from. A 529 lets your money grow for you tax-free, and that's why it needs to be used for educational purposes.
Okay.
For that reason. A custodial account is a gift. That money is actually gifted to that person. So it is their money. It's not for anyone else. You cannot change the beneficiary on that. And so there's usually age restrictions on that. At some point, whether it's 18 or 21, that money is now their money, the grandchild's money.
So remember how to spell my name correctly.
Yes,
all right?
Okay. You got it.
Okay. And any other accounts that, you know, somebody can invest in if they're thinking about a child's future that would not be limiting? And is this money taxed?
Yeah, you can always open up a regular brokerage account where it is a taxable account. You can designate it for that individual. However, they have to be of age to be able to open up an account. That's why a custodial account is usually good for someone that is 18 years or younger. However, they can always put it into a single account in their own name and let that grow and then
transfer
and transfer it over at a different time for the grandchild. Yeah.
So how does that affect their taxes, Mark?
When you look at a traditional brokerage account, it is a taxable account, but it's not as scary as it sounds. Normally, what you see coming out of an account like that will be dividends, interest, and capital gains. And the interest, if it's regular interest from corporate bonds or something of that nature, that's treated as ordinary income. You also have interest from municipal bonds, which would be tax exempt. And when you get into capital gains and dividends, those both get preferential treatment on your tax return. And if you're single and your income's under $50,000, or if you're married and your income's under $100,000, those are all taxed at 0%. So it still goes on your return and it's still taxed, but it's taxed at 0%. So it's not as bad as it seems. If your income exceeds those thresholds, the next level is at 15%. And then if your income is really high, then it goes up to 20%. And if you're paying the 20% level of taxes, the rest of your income is being taxed at 35%. So there's still a significant savings by having investment income on your tax return.
I think the main goal is to figure out what do you want this money to do for you? Do you want it to be a legacy for your inheritors? Do you want it to grow for you to help provide additional income for your retirement? You just got to think about it and what you want it to do. And then you invest the money accordingly. And therefore, if it's in a regular brokerage account or a 529 account or a custodial account, you pick the proper investments that would correspond to maximizing each account.
So when you're thinking about a reverse mortgage and you're thinking of these scenarios, and there's so many other ways to use a reverse mortgage, I've only had once when I was interviewing a lady for her reverse mortgage where a child, you know, you can't do that, that's my inheritance. And I said, no, actually, this is her money. I mean, she's still here. Unless we, you know, bump her off now, she's still here. It's her money. You know, and it's like, you know, you have to think about how are you going to take care of your family, too? And this person was not in any position to financially support the mom. The mom was in a position to financially support herself with a reverse mortgage, made her life a little more comfortable. But, you know, you have to think of yourself first because you might, you know, you're going to live.
There's a lot that goes into this decision-making process. And unfortunately, a lot of people get to retirement age and they have failed to save at all or failed to save adequately. And when you get to that stage and you're at 62 or at 65 and your options are Social Security alone because you have no other savings or the ability to tap into your greatest asset, which is your house, it shouldn't be ruled out. The opposite end of this, and we see this a lot. This is something that happens multiple times every single year. I get a phone call. Somebody comes in. There's been a death in the family. They've inherited this house. And nobody's done any maintenance on this house in quite a while. And so you get to that stage where your parents or grandparents, aunt, uncle, doesn't matter who it is, they stop maintaining the house. They just start accepting the things that are happening, the things that don't work anymore, the roof that hasn't been maintained, the exterior that hasn't been painted, or the carpet that's still there from the 1970s.
They can't afford it.
And they can't afford it. Yeah. And so there's the realistic possibility that 20 years has gone by and nothing's been changed or updated or fixed in these houses. And now somebody's sitting in my office, hey, I inherited this house and we need to spend $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 to get it ready to sell. And so when you have this conversation of, I don't want to do a reverse mortgage because I want my kids to inherit the house, do they really want to inherit it? Is there other options? Are you living your best life in your golden years? And can we do something different? Whether that's paying for someone's college through that 529 plan or building an additional legacy for other family members that's outside of everybody fighting over this house or everybody fighting to get away from this house.
Yeah, that's
when,
usually
when
the
you
thing.
Pass on. And that we see that a lot. Like, hey, yeah. Five of us just inherited this house and nobody wants to deal with it.
Yeah.
And we've had cases where it'll sit there for years untouched, which doesn't make it better. It actually makes the situation worse because then it can become vandalized, drug house, a homeless house. Like, there's a lot of things that can happen that make this situation worse where had you done something differently or had this cash tied up in other assets, stocks, bonds, these pass on to the heirs relatively easily. And then the house is a separate issue that's much easier to deal with when people aren't fighting over how we're going to sell it or are we going to keep it or are we going to turn it into a rental property. And, you know, you've got one or two people that want to do something and two or three other people that don't want to do something, but can save a lot of headache on the back end as well. People inheriting something that they didn't really want.
And I think people can do themselves a favor and their family a favor. If they have several kids, appoint somebody as the executor or the executrix, and that person makes the decisions for everybody.
Yes.
And when you've got, you know, like you said, a family of five and everybody has an input, well, you know, it has to be a unanimous decision. You can't, you know, so it causes problem. It causes grief. And with the reverse mortgage, the loan is on the house. It's not on the person. It's not on your beneficiaries. The loan is on the house. And if somebody really wanted to buy that house, they'd only have to pay 95% of the appraised value. And, you know, that house could be totally upside down in debt, but you're not going to have to worry about that. And that's why they have mortgage insurance. It makes the bank whole and keeps you from being in debt when you don't want to be. We're going to take another quick break here, and we'll be back in a few. Okay, thanks for staying with us. Our guests today are Wyatt McCray from Edward Jones and Mark Barnes, who is the owner and enrolled agent from the Copper Canyon Tax Service. And we're here talking about what to do and not to do. Year's end, taxes are going to be coming along. And how to find a qualified financial advisor, how to find a qualified tax person. And sometimes, you know, going through the phone book isn't necessarily phone book, yeah. Google searching isn't necessarily the answer. I could tell you some horror stories. Wyatt, how do you find a financial advisor that's qualified to do what they say they're doing?
I think the biggest thing is to go out and interview, right? You want to find someone that relates well to you, that you can build a relationship of trust with. There's other things that you can do when researching financial advisors. A great website to go to is BrokerCheck. And BrokerCheck will actually list all financial advisors and any kind of maybe derogatory marks that they have or the kind of service that they've provided to which companies that they've been a part of. And you can go in, type in the person's first name and last name, what company they work for, and what town that they're working in, and I'll bring up all of their information. We have what is called a U4 form, which our information is public, and you get to see what kind of licenses that they have, what kind of qualifications that they have. For me, working with Edward Jones, I am considered a financial advisor. I have to have certain licenses to be able to have that title. You can't call yourself a financial advisor without having a Series 7, a Series 66, and a health and life licenses.
So you have to go to college and get educated.
Well, you gotta pass the right exams for that. Yeah, and I have a degree at the University of Arizona, and after that was able to work with Edward Jones to get my licenses. So,
what's your degree in?
Molecular cellular biology.
I see it served you well.
I use it every day. It looks really good on my wall here.
That's funny. I've had people, and I meet all kinds of people being in the loan industry. I've had people come to me, their family trust was written by their CPA, and they want to refinance their house or get a reverse mortgage, and I'm looking at the trust, and I, you know, you don't own this house. Your cousin you haven't seen in decades that you listed as your successor trustee owns the house. We need to find this person so that you can refinance the house. And, you know, just horror stories. And I know what a misplaced comma can do to the outcome of an estate.
And that were, and that's, that comes in the fact of finding someone that you can trust and build a good relationship with. You need to interview. You need to do the proper due diligence to search out.
There's an attorney in town. Well, he used to be an attorney. He's been disbarred from several states. But he's also a financial planner, in that he will have people come in. He tells them what to do. He sets up their wills, trusts, and estates law. And I'm just like, I had to deal with one of his family trusts too, and it was totally screwed up. Yeah. We had to hire another attorney to fix it they could do a reverse mortgage.
Not all advisors are created equal here.
No, they're not.
Nope.
So, I know you've got horror stories, Mark. You've told me a few.
I don't think a month goes by that we don't see a horror story. On the tax side of things, we have a problem. And that is that in most states, you don't have to have any type of education, license, or credential to call yourself a tax preparer. So
that's comforting.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And that's where their messes come from most of the time. So it, from the consumer's perspective, it's always a nice place to start with the people that you already know, the people that you already trust, and get their opinion. When you get into somebody's office, don't expect a full interview process if it's during tax season. But my office is open all year, and we spent the entire summer talking with people, interviewing both directions, because you may not be a good fit for us, and we may not be a good fit for you. Yep. But also identifying the things that we can help with. And the things you should really be looking out for are, how is your information being treated? You're about to hand over all of your personal, confidential information to somebody. Is it going to be secure? Is it going to be kept in a manner that it should be? Is it going to be disclosed to anybody without your consent? This year, as we renewed our prepare ID number, we're required to check off a box that says we have a written data security plan, and we're required by law now to protect your personal and confidential information. And these are things that a lot of people are skipping over. They see dollar signs or big refund, or people are making promises that they can't really fulfill, and they're not considering who's getting their information, where that person's going to be next year, that relationship, is this going to be a long-term thing, and how's this person going to help you, one, today, get your taxes filed correctly, and two, how's this person going to help you if something should go wrong and you start getting notices from the IRS or Department of Revenue? So it's complicated because there's some people that are unenrolled, and this means they don't have any official credentialing, and they do a fantastic job. And there's enrolled agents that do a fantastic job, and there's CPAs that do a fantastic job, and there's attorneys that do a fantastic job of preparing taxes. And you also have people that are horrible in all four of those categories. So we don't have a simple system that you can just look up somebody and see what their history is.
Does the IRS have a list of people that are maybe bad actors?
If you are a really bad actor, yes. But this is usually after somebody like Brian has come and visited you.
Brian is a special agent with the IRS.
Yes, and you've been indicted of actually committing some type of a crime like tax fraud. And then you have the potential of being disallowed by the IRS to prepare tax returns for compensation. But these are rare cases. Outside of that, when I renew my license every 3 years, I just have to check off that I haven't been convicted of a felony. Doesn't mean I didn't do a whole bunch of other bad stuff. I just didn't commit a felony and get convicted.
So do you want to tell us what bad stuff you've done lately?
No.
Oh.
We'll talk about that off air.
Okay.
Nothing.
Nothing. I know you. I know you. You're a good guy. Is there a category when you're filing your taxes for surplus money? Do you have to declare surplus money?
So the Internal Revenue Code is fairly specific. Any money that you receive is taxable income unless it's excluded somewhere else in the tax code.
Like a reverse mortgage.
Like a reverse mortgage. So that's excluded. Gifts are excluded. But if you picked up some furniture on the side of the road and you took it home and you refinished it and then you resold it, that's income to you. That should be reported on your tax return. If you are a server and you're paid in cash, that is income to you. That's money in exchange for labor, and that's reportable, and that should be on your tax return.
So there is no surplus income
category. Everything has a place where it belongs. And if it doesn't belong anywhere else, we have a specific line for the catch-all, all other types of income.
Which line is that?
They keep changing the postcard.
The postcard.
So I'm not sure where it is this year. It used to be line 19.
Okay.
But then they made it a postcard, and now it's a bigger postcard, and I don't. Within 2 or 3 years, we're going to be back to the form that we started with. So I'm trying not to memorize all the new variations of the postcard.
Okay. When you're talking about postcard, are you talking about the 990?
No. This is the postcard that was advertised as your individual income tax return, the 1040. It used to be 10 pages. And then it was pitched as it's going to be so simple, you're going to just mail in a postcard, which is ridiculous because nobody mails in their tax returns. Everybody e-files, and the computer system doesn't care how big the piece of paper is. The electronic information flows in to their database from my database, and that's the end of it. We're not mailing postcards or full pieces of paper.
Okay, I want to talk about, I've seen a lot of ads at the end of the year. You know, all these charities, and we're one too, all these charities are saying, you know, give to us, you can get a state credit.
Yes.
Okay. How does that state credit affect your federal return?
So historically, we had the ability to double dip, and we would put this on your federal return as a charitable contribution if you were itemizing, and then it would show up on your state return. We would back it out of your state itemized deductions, and instead we would take it as a dollar for dollar credit. And after the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017 passed, a lot of states started getting creative on how they were going to manage some of their taxes and revenue and deductions, and they put a halt to all of this. So now you have to reduce your federal deduction by the amount of any credits that you receive. So when you put this on your Arizona return, let's say you donated $1,000, you got a deduction of $1,000 already, which leaves you $0 to deduct on your federal return. So it's no longer a deduction on your federal, but it still shows up on your state return. And we encourage people to take advantage of these credits. It's giving you an opportunity to spend your money where you want to in exchange for sending money to the Department of Revenue and having the government spend your money
where they want to.
Where they want to. But at the end of the day, if your tax liability was $2,000, you're either going to send $2,000 to the Department of Revenue or $2,000 to the charities of your choice. If you're still out of pocket this money, then you have to decide from there. Do I want to send it to the government, or would I rather help the charity that's helping people in my community, creating jobs in my community?
That's a good way to look at it.
Yeah.
And how does that affect your financial? Do you advise people to, you know, give to charity?
I think if you have a charity that's important to you and you have an ability to contribute to that charity and direct it specifically that money to that charity, then by all means, it's a great thing to do. It's financially wise, you're going to have to pay the money one way or another. So if you like giving it to the IRS, then that's a great place to go. If you like it to go to your church or radio show, that's up to you. So,
and there's a lot of different ways that you can give to charity. I know we are listed, Law Matters is listed with Amazon Smiles. If you, mm-hmm. know, that's a charity mm-hmm. thing. If you go down there, Law Matters is listed, and there is one of the charities you can contribute to.
I think one of the biggest ones that we do, we always take advantage of the, our kids go to a charter school, and we always make sure we get not only ourselves to contribute to that, but our family members and people that live in Arizona that can contribute to that school to get them to do that.
Which school is that?
That's a Hermosa Montessori.
Okay.
On the east side, but okay. Great little school.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Is it a high school too?
No, it ends at eighth grade. Eighth grade, yeah.
So. Okay. All right. I know there's a lot of schools I was contributing to because we thought the education was going to improve in Arizona, and the 30 years I've been here, it has not. So I'm going to find a different charity. But anyway, I see we have to take a break. We'll be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. Our guests today are Mark Barnes from Copper Canyon Tax Service and Wyatt McRae from Edward Jones. We've been talking about how to hire a professional and not get in trouble with the person you're hiring, and how to investigate and research that person. Because, you know, like I said, we've got an attorney in town that, or a former attorney who was disbarred from several places, and he's doing wills, trusts, and estates and not that great a job at it. Mark, tell us about this guy that got indicted.
It's hard to get this across because it's super specific. When you're looking for somebody to prepare your taxes, you want somebody that's good at what they do. But you want to avoid people that are making promises that seem unreasonable, or people that claim that they specialize in an area that's so specific that it just doesn't seem to make sense. And over the years, we've come across this multiple times with firefighters, police officers, and most recently this one in Green Valley. And so the claim is, you should come to me to get your taxes done because I specialize in firefighters and I know all the special code. There's not a special code for firefighters. There's not a special code for police officers. And the guy in Green Valley's claim was he knew all the special code for Border Patrol agents. And what that translates to is, I'm going to deduct a bunch of stuff on your return that's not deductible. And we're just going to run the risk that you don't get audited. And this gentleman found himself on the wrong side of the law and has since been indicted on filing false tax returns and fraudulent claims. And this is something that can be
a problem.
It's a problem. And this guy could be sentenced to jail time, like real jail time with real penalties. There was recently one in Phoenix that happened, and the restitution starts getting into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And as the taxpayer, you have to understand, you're signing the tax return under penalty of perjury that this is true and correct to the best of your knowledge. And if something seems weird to you, it should raise the flag that at the end of the day, you're responsible for this, no matter what this person says. So if their specialty is something that is so tiny or so niche, like we specialize in Border Patrol, that should be the flag right there. Because there's not special code for specific industries. The things that apply to general industries in a broad spectrum.
Okay, if that goes to court, you've signed saying, you know, I solemnly swear this is true to the best of my knowledge. But you put your trust and faith in somebody who's spewing, you know, this con person who's spewing BS. What is the balance of, you know, hey, I trusted him to do my taxes, and I signed because he said this was allowed. Is how many different lawsuits do we have going here?
So you run into a bunch of problems here. And at the end of the day, it's your tax return and you owed the taxes, and you're the one that's now going to pay the price.
You're on the hook for his bad behavior.
You're on the hook. So step one is go seek competent help. You don't have to deal with the IRS alone. There's actually, if you look up publication one, it's your rights as a taxpayer. And one of those is the right to representation. And when you start getting into a position where the IRS is coming after you for money, you owe the money. I can't help you with that. But there's provisions in there that we can use where you relied on someone's professional judgment, and we can reduce or eliminate some of the penalties if we can build this case. From there, another thing you want to check on is what type of insurance does the person have that you're going to? We have errors and omissions. We have a full process where we review, and we're working on collecting data in the most accurate way possible, but we're all human, and sometimes things happen and mistakes are made. And we have an insurance policy that's in place for this. And so if something goes wrong, you let me know. Like if I'm indicted and I'm in jail, that's a different situation. But if your tax return is messed up, we're gonna help you fix it. And if need be, we can file a claim with our insurance, which will reimburse you for some of these costs.
So yeah, you wanna make sure that whoever you're dealing with has E&O insurance. It's really important how they handle your paperwork. Do they have secure systems on, you know, their computers, or are they just, you know, out there loose and, you know, nothing secure? That's not cool. So, and what about hiring a financial planner?
Well, I think whether it's financial planning that you need, or a reverse mortgage, or tax help, there's always a cost associated in hiring a professional, right? I think cost is always an issue in the absence of value. And so you want to make sure that your relationship or the professional that you're working with, one, has the proper licenses and qualifications to be helping you. Are you the type of person that thinks that they can do it on their own? Go on YouTube, watch a couple videos.
And
figure it out. I mean, how many times, Mark, do you find someone, hey, I bought TurboTax and did my taxes, and all of a sudden they got a letter in the mail saying, hey, the IRS is requiring some extra funds because you filed your taxes incorrectly. Or
those
how many
are
times
fantastic.
Have I, yeah,
that,
those
that's
are,
how I fund my vacations, by all the cleanup work from those types of returns.
And so I think, you know, if you're the kind of person where your toilet breaks, are you going to go to Home Depot and figure it out yourself with the internet, right? Or are you going to call the plumber that's going to come out and do the right job correctly the first time? And yes, it may cost a little bit more to do it that way, but you have a professional doing the work for you. Likewise with mortgages, taxes, and financial advising, if you don't see the value that's coming from that, then cost is going to be an issue for you. And I think if you find the right person, it's not going to be an issue. And that gives you the right kind of professional help.
So. And I've had people, you know, they want a family trust, but they don't want to hire an attorney to do it. Right. You know, like I said, they had their CPA do it, and it caused months of grief and mm-hmm. aggravation trying to figure that out. And when you're researching somebody, don't just go to their website and look at their profile. Google search them and find out where they've really been, what they've really done, and how many other states they've been kicked out of because of their bad acts. And
I think as an individual, you have all the power to find the right person. You have all the power within you to do your due diligence, to go out and research what you need to do to interview who you need to interview.
Oh, and in today's age too, you know, the information is at your fingertips.
Absolutely.
But, you know, that doesn't make you an attorney who can write up a family trust. And people don't realize when you buy and sell properties, every time you buy and sell something, if your car is in that family trust, you sold it, hey, you need to update that family trust, you know? And they'll sit there for years and, oh, that house was sold 20 years ago. Well, why didn't you update the family trust?
Yeah.
You know? So, or like you were telling the story about somebody who inherited the house down the line, nobody bothered to change the deed because they just inherited the house and it's fine.
Yeah, and we've had situations where the title is being held in like a great grandfather's name and it's been titled exactly the same since 1915 and now they're trying to sell this house and it's a huge problem and it becomes a giant burden and legal expense, and it's all those things because it didn't get taken care of. Somebody thought they could do it quicker, faster, cheaper, and then you end up spending hundreds of hours and thousands of dollars to get this stuff fixed instead of just doing it right the first time.
Yeah, and it might cost you a little bit more up front, but in the long run, you're covering, my dad would say, CYA. So cover your assets. So what plans do you guys have for the new year? You going to go out and party New Year's Eve?
No, I'll be in bed by probably 9 or 9:30. Like many tax preparers out there, I have 2 hours of ethics that I need to take before December 31st. And that's usually the last class that gets taken because they're boring. And, well, some of us need it and some of us don't. And I'm in the second category. Aside from that, it's just ramping up, making sure that all of our stuff is secure in the office. We have our IT company coming in to do an update and check, check all of our encryption, double check all of our backup systems, and make sure that everything is running and smooth before tax season starts. And then in January, that's it. W-2s, 1099s, tax returns, and hallelujah when April 16th gets here.
You have to go through the same thing. You have to have all kinds of security on your systems as well.
Yeah, I get all my CE credits done before they get us
before
done
now.
Before November 1st. You have until the December 31st to get it done, but my company makes me make sure I get it done right away. So
I don't think people realize how much continuing ed we all have to go through to do the jobs that we do. And it is. It's a lot. And, you know, I have to do it for insurance. I have to do it for loan officer. I have to do it for paralegal and fingerprints. And you'll never see me on a wanted poster.
So New Year's for me will be relatively calm as well. I'm not wanting to do too much.
Yeah, I don't want everybody going out there drinking and driving. That's just insane. But there are some things that you could do to guarantee. This is guaranteed that you'll have a good New Year. You could eat grapes at the stroke of midnight.
Okay.
One grape for each bell that rings. So you have to scarf them down in order to get good luck. They say that if you eat pomegranates, that guarantees you'll be fertile.
Okay.
So, you know.
We'll be avoiding those.
I'll be avoiding those too. And in Denmark, they throw plates at your front door to wish you luck. They trash their china on your front door. So, yeah, I know.
Must have good doors in Denmark.
In Colombia, for good luck, they walk around the block with an empty suitcase.
Our kids jump in the swimming pool to be the first one in the swimming
for
pool.
For the New Year?
For the New Year.
That's awesome. So, okay, I want to thank everybody again. Last week was awesome going to Mod Pizza in Oro Valley. They had great food, and it was fun to see everybody and meet everybody. Some of the listeners came in and introduced themselves, so that was cool. And like I said, don't go out drinking and driving, please. We want you to be here next week so you can hear our show. Until then, shop local, stay safe, and we'll talk to you. Thanks, guys, for coming in.
Thank you. Welcome.